Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay, so tonight's a Spirit Rock Teen Weekend. Group are here, and a lot of things might be unfamiliar to you, like just what happened. Anagarika and Jeff just recited a verse that is a formal request to give Dhamma or teach on Dhamma, and it's what it is a verse from the scriptures that recollects the time when the right after the Buddha himself was awakened, enlightened, and his inclination was that this Dhamma that I've experienced and seen is just too refined, too difficult to understand, too difficult to try to transmit it. I'm not going to bother teaching. And according to the mythology or the story, then one of the Brahma gods realized what the Buddha was thinking and said, "Oh, this is a disaster," and came down, appeared before the Buddha and made a request for the Buddha to teach out of compassion for the world, that there were those with little dust in their eyes who could understand. And so it's, as the story goes, then the Buddha then set his intention to teach. And so that's something as a tradition or a ceremony, then as a formal request to give teachings. And also by our own discipline as monastics, we're actually not allowed to teach unless somebody is interested or is makes a request and is respectful, wanting to listen. You know, we can't sort of set up our soapbox in Golden Gate Park and just start transmit the truth. So they let everybody know the good word. So that, people have to show an interest. And then when, what I did was to then, okay, there's a request to give teachings, I'll make a respectful recollection of the Buddha. So Namo Tassa Bhagavato are the traditional respectful verses, recollecting the qualities of the Buddha. Because the Buddha's primary qualities are wisdom, purity, and compassion. And that Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa are recollecting those qualities. Namo Tassa is sort of, I pay homage. And the Bhagava, the Blessed One, or one who brings blessings, is he does that out of compassion. So it's recollecting quality of compassion. And Arahato is, arahant, meaning awakened, enlightened, but literally what it means is far from defilement. So there's a purity there. And Sammasambuddhassa is fully self-awakened, so that the Buddha relied on his own wisdom, discernment, practice to understand. So this is recollecting the the wisdom of the Buddha. Of course, what it also points to is the qualities that we ourselves need to cultivate and develop and have a balance of those qualities. Because they sometimes say somebody might have wisdom in terms of intelligent, discerning, but maybe lacking in a certain purity and compassion, and they can be somebody who is they can be either cold or unforgiving or judgmental. They might be right because they figured it out, but they're kind of intolerable to be around. Or there might be purity, but not wisdom and compassion supporting it. So that, somebody who is really obsessed with purity and trying to get everything right and get everybody right along with them can also be a real pain in the butt. So there, so that sense of compassion and wisdom needs to balance that purity. What are we cultivating purity for? Because it's easy to sort of, I'm pure and I have to deal with the unwashed masses. It's really, it's not very pleasant. And it's very, very lonely as well. And compassion can sometimes, if it's not balanced with wisdom and purity, compassion feels for others, has empathy, sympathy, but it can be overwhelming because there's a need to be able to respond and feel the suffering and limitations of oneself and the world around us. But if we're not balanced and have a clear perspective and understand our own wholesome intention, then it can be overwhelming. It's like somebody who, has compassion and feels that, love for the world, love for others, but is lacking that wisdom and purity, can create sorrow in the heart. But when compassion is linked with and balanced with wisdom and purity, then what results is a lot of joy and a real brightness of heart. So those are the qualities that the Buddha exemplified himself and, of course, tried to encourage us as his students, followers, to cultivate and develop. So that in giving a Dhamma talk, it's like that recollecting what we're what the purpose is and where it all comes from. It comes from the Buddha, so that it's a setting of an intention to try to bring benefit, as opposed to trying to convey information. I want you to all get your Buddhist facts straight. or to try to be, because there can be a lot of self that comes up, especially in terms of teaching, feeling one has to teach, or that sense of either wanting to be liked or wanting to be for people to understand. Those are all kind of pitfalls. So they're really trying to say, well, no, what one's trying to do is trying to follow in the footsteps of the Buddha and learn how to relinquish and give. One of the things that my teacher Ajahn Chah used to do was he would sometimes call on us to teach, and sometimes you wouldn't have time to prepare, and that was exactly the point, because there's no way you can really prepare other than your own practice. There was one time the senior Western monk, Ajahn Sumedho, gave a teaching, and he knew it was only his first or second time that he was asked to give a Dhamma talk, but he knew ahead of time that he was going to do that, so he kind of lined up some teachings in his mind, reviewed some of the principles, got some suttas back behind him, and then gave this Dhamma talk and laid out the Buddha's teachings and passed on. Because especially in Thailand, when we first began teaching, you're teaching in a second language which you're not that fluent in yet, and then you're not comfortable sitting up in front of people and giving talks. And anyway, he figured he did a pretty good job giving this Dhamma talk, and then he got down, came back. Also, one of the things that we would do if there's a senior monk who's presiding over the ceremony that day, then you would pay respects to him after. So Ajahn Sumedho paid respects to Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Chah sort of said, don't do that again. don't prepare. And there was another time, Ajahn Sumedho had been a monk for some time, and he'd been, because he was the first Westerner, he does have a charisma, and he's also out in the countryside of the backwoods of northeastern Thailand, and kind of 6'4" big white guy, he stands out, and so he got quite a bit of experience. But then one time, Ajahn Chah announced to the whole community, and so Ajahn Sumedho, he'd been doing teaching, so he'd keep it really, really short, really concise, give 20 minutes, no more than half an hour, just get it right down. So Ajahn Chah made a big announcement to the whole community that was there. Ajahn Sumedho's going to give a talk tonight, and he's going to give a 3-hour talk to everybody. So he said, So he got up and finished his little half an hour spiel that he was comfortable with, and went to get off the Dhamma seat. Because in Thailand, you're usually in a large hall, and it's a raised seat, usually about this high. So he went to get off, and Ajahn Chah said, no, you keep talking. And so he's kind of, oh, what the hell? So he tried to keep going, but after an hour, he said, tried to stop again. Keep going. So that after an hour, then people started getting up and going out. they were kind of bored, and Ajahn Sumedho tried to get off the Dhamma seat again. No, keep talking. People were lying down, getting up and walking out. And it was, he made him sit up there and give a talk for 3 hours. And it was really we were talking at tea time how sometimes Ajahn Chah could be fierce or could be mean, but it was usually, you're really out of compassion. And Ajahn Sumedho said after that he was never afraid to bore people because usually what you want in teaching you don't want to bore people, you don't want to people to be disappointed in you, there's nobody he's talking about or anything, but and that's exactly the point that Ajahn Chah was trying to get across. It's not about you. Just teach and teach from your heart, and whether people understand or don't understand, or like it or don't like it, it's not so relevant. Because usually we spend our lives trying to be liked, trying to be wanted, and trying to feel comfortable. And obviously you don't go out of your way to just offend people but to be able to be free internally of that fear of, of not being praised or of not being accepted or not being liked in some way, that's incredibly liberating. Because that kind of fear is really quite deep in our psyche and our makeup as human beings, and of course there's one of those roots of self that where we carry around this sense of identification, wanting to be somebody or something. Usually it's really ill-defined keeps changing because that's the nature of self and nature of any kind of phenomena. So we tend to spend our life being afraid of these shadows that something's going to leap out and terrify us and make us uncomfortable. When we're able to just, look at that. That's not interesting. And that's what practice is. It isn't some incredible willful effort to annihilate self. It's just learning to recognize, look where that sense of self comes from. And look how that works. And it doesn't really have any substance. Of course we feel it, but it doesn't really have a solid essence to it. So that's where we can start to really learn. And so these teachings of the essence of insight in the Buddhist practice is around impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, non-self. And it isn't a matter of just repeating those phrases or labeling everything, it's just impermanent, it'll go away. It's more like, how do we hold it? How do we feel about it? How does it affect us when something is impermanent, uncertain, unsure? And then what skills do we apply to that? What wholesome qualities do we bring to that? And that's how we learn. And that's how we undermine that tendency to suffering or to discontent, dissatisfaction, dis-ease. That quality of, like the word in Pali in the scriptural language for suffering is dukkha. And dukkha in the language of at the time of the Buddha, it's a very ancient word in the northern Indian language, and northern India was a horse culture. They actually came from further north and came into India. And there's a it's a horse culture. So there was chariots and wagons and wheels, and so that there's the there like two words are like sukha is happiness, dukkha is unhappiness or suffering, and like su means kind of good and duk not so good. But kha is the hole where the axle goes in a chariot or in a wagon. So like dukkha, it's like that fit is not very good. It doesn't fit well. It doesn't rotate smoothly. It's not comfortable. There's dis-ease in its movement. It really is uncomfortable and unpleasant. And so dukkha is this suffering, discontent, dissatisfaction, stress. And so it's it's an interesting, so like something that's really central to the Buddhist teachings is actually something that's very ordinary. So being able to see, well, where are these areas that where it's rubbing us the wrong way or it's really uncomfortable? And that's what the Buddha wants us to investigate, being able to look at that quality of dukkha. Not in the sense of, oh, woe is me, there's dukkha again, because that's just a lot more self, or trying to overanalyze it, psychologize it, but more, what's it like as an experience? And how do I work with that? How do I free the heart from that kind of dis-ease? Yeah. How do I understand it? In the Buddha's first teaching, he pointed to, that was that first teaching that he gave was a teaching that he continued to teach and develop and expand on and use as a linchpin in all of the teachings. There's Four Noble Truths, there is suffering, there's a cause to this suffering, this dukkha. There is a cessation of dukkha, there's a path, there's a way that leads to the end of dukkha. So it isn't just the one ultimate truth of dukkha. I mean, there is this experience. There is a cause. There is a cessation. There is an ending. But also the Buddha pointed to the way we need to relate to this experience of dukkha, this truth of dukkha. It isn't just that they're abstract truths, or they're some theoretical or philosophical truth. They are this experience, and then there's the things that we have to do with them, to them. The word that the Buddha uses is there's the duty or responsibility that we have to those truths. So that dukkha, suffering, discontent, is to be known, or it's to be understood. So that's something when we experience something that makes us uncomfortable, or it feels overwhelming, or it feels difficult, then to be willing to know it, because usually the first response or our kind of our gut reaction is, how do I get out of this? Where do I run from here? You know, it's so that willingness to turn and face it. And I remember one time early on living with Ajahn Chah, and I was asking him and talking with him, letting him know that I had I was experiencing this particular difficulty and had misbehaved in a particular way and sort of letting him know and talking about it and I was feeling remorseful and uncertain of what to do. And Ajahn Chah listened, and he was very present, and he was listening to me, and very present, and I didn't feel any kind of reaction or judgment. And then he just asked a very simple question. I said, "Was it suffering?" And that was the only thing he asked me at that time. Was it suffering? That was the one thing he wanted me to see. How was that suffering? How did that play into that experience? Because was I dealing with it at that point? And what was the feeling? What was I doing? And how did it determine what I ended up doing? I was feeling at the time. So it's just really being able to say, okay, this suffering has to be known, has to be understood. And then the cause of suffering is to be abandoned, so that in knowing and understanding, then a picture starts to emerge where you say, that's where that comes from, that's the cause. But and that's where we have to pay attention to, how do I abandon that? How do I put that down in terms of the cause? Because usually, you know, what we really want to abandon is the suffering. We experience some suffering, some discontent, dissatisfaction, and what we really want to abandon, what we want to get rid of, what we want to let go of, is the suffering. But usually we want to keep the causes, because it's deeply ingrained as a habit. There's a certain satisfaction sometimes. It's like living in a monastery just full of poison oak, and you get poison oak, and it feels so good to scratch it. And you know you shouldn't. And you know it's not good, but it feels so good to scratch it. That's the unwillingness to abandon the cause of suffering. and we do it in so many different ways. That's a kind of a mundane way to point at it. But it's, we do that. Or like having a hot shower when you've got poison oak. It really hurts, but it feels good. So lining up, what is the thing, what is the response that we have to have that is most skillful? So that abandoning the cause. And the path leading to cessation of suffering, say the appropriate response or the duty that we should have to it, that is to be cultivated or to be developed. And it's the same word, there's actually not many words for in the Buddhist language. For meditation is the way we think of it, but the word bhavana is usually used for some of the people who are somewhat familiar. Bhavana is like meditation, practice, training, cultivation. But it's the same verb that the Buddha says. That's to be the path leading to cessation of suffering is Mahavetabha Dhamma. It's to be cultivated, developed. And so it's what we put our effort into. And then the cessation of suffering, the ending of suffering, is to be realized. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, in very ordinary ways or in very mundane ways or even in little things, you know, that we're experiencing an ending of our discomfort or difficulty. But we don't take the time to realize it. Because something that we've already experienced as we've been having some difficulty, there's a relief from it. It's usually quite fleeting that we kind of notice it, but then we go on to the next thing. And we look for some other problem to pick up, or some other task to do, or something to keep us busy. And we don't give the heart the opportunity to really realize and to experience fully that cessation, that ending of suffering. It's like, just pay attention when you're doing breath meditation. You go in breath, out breath, and usually your mindfulness is pretty good at the beginning of the breath. The end, just as it's ending, you're usually already moving. It's just the nature of the mind. It's what minds do. That's why it's really important to say, "Oh, this is not self." Because if it was really self, we'd be screwed. But it's not self. It's the way minds work. They move. They look for something else. They're seeking. Taking that reality, that it's just like that, and then being willing to direct attention in a way that's skillful. So really paying attention to that cessation, that ending, and realize, there's a very beautiful phrase that the Buddha uses bringing up the perception of cessation. Because sometimes you think cessation, ending, go. You know, it's like scary, it's going to end. And so we want to fill the mind up with more things. There's this bringing up the perception of cessation, and it's with this is peaceful, this is sublime. The stilling of all formations, the ending, the ending. It's in the sense of coming to a place of stillness. It's incredibly satisfying. But we have to turn our attention there. We have to become familiar with it. We have to be willing to come back. Because, you know, the habit of the mind is to look for something else, fill it up in some other way. Keep it moving. Let's keep it moving here. In our practice, these Four Noble Truths are, you know, they really form the core of the Buddha's teachings, the essence of the practice, and they're exceedingly practical. One doesn't need a PhD in Buddhist metaphysics to understand the Four Noble Truths. But you have to be willing to be attentive, to be alert, and to give yourself to it, and to give yourself to the path that the Buddha gives of cultivation of our body, speech, and mind, and then to allow the heart to really to grow and to settle in these truths. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening. So.